You may, Mr. Chandler, good morning to you, but let's give everybody a second to get in and out of the courtroom. And I believe that has occurred, so you may proceed.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Eric Chandler, attorney for appellant Daniel Bernard in this case. And if I could, I'd like to reserve 2 minutes of rebuttal time. This case is, what it's really about is it's about a landlord who leased a rental property that had been deemed uninhabitable by the city of Omaha. A rental property that had been shown to have defective front steps, and where the city of Omaha had determined that the property was unsafe, uninhabitable, and unfit for human occupancy. Rather than making the repairs to the house as mandated in the notice of violation from the city of Omaha, McDowell proceeded to go ahead and lease out the premises with no repairs being made. The house was rented to Ms. Bernard, who lived in the house for a period of time and then ultimately suffered an injury due directly to the defective steps, which were referenced in the original notice violation for which the house was deemed uninhabitable in the first place.
Anything hidden about that? The precise nature of the defect was
in the notice of violation states sunken steps. The precise defect that Ms. Bernard was injured on is she was wearing heels, her heel got stuck in a crack that was between the house where the steps had settled, causing her fall off the property, both had a subsequent surgery. As far as essentially the entire defense in this case, and that is the basis for which, when this case was brought in front of the trial court on a motion for summary judgment, is clearly the basis for why McDowell's motion for summary judgment was sustained.
Let me back up here a little bit. So there's a gap.
Let me go back again to what the lease provided. The judge quoted part of the lease, is that right? In the order.
I believe the judge, most of the quote, and I apologize, I don't recall that. I know that the judge did make a large reference to Tolbert versus Jameson and then went through the jury instruction analysis in the opinion.
And, okay, and in your view, what is the holding in Tolbert versus Jameson?
Well, in my view, the issue, this court stated that in Tolbert, there was an analysis with regard to duty, and there was an analysis with regard to foreseeability. So in Tolbert, the situation was there was a fire. The plaintiffs in that case brought the action for damages for injuries and death caused as a result of the fire, but the defendant in the case didn't cause the fire. It was an arson. The entire case had to do with the defendant, the claim was that the defendant had violated code sections in not having a second entrance or exit from the premises. And at the motion for summary judgment, the defendant put on evidence that, in fact, they were in compliance and there were no code violations. So that was essentially the case. And in this court, in Tolbert, stated that the question of whether a legal duty exists for actionable negligence is a question of law dependent on the facts of a particular situation.
So with respect to the broad picture of what's the law applicable in Tolbert v. Jameson, the order of the court says, quoting Tolbert, with reference to a single-family unit, the law may be summarized as follows, quote, as a general rule, in the absence of statute, covenant, fraud, or concealment, a landlord who gives the tenant full control, and so forth, basically saying it's the landlord is absolved of routine
Correct.
Stuff, right. But there's a phrase in there, in the absence of statute, covenant, fraud, or concealment, so that takes me back to your lease. Is there a covenant that the landlord will do certain things during the term?
There's not a covenant. Rather, this case has to do with the statutes, the fraud, and the concealment. This is a situation where, in Tolbert, if the facts had been that there was, in fact, a violation of an ordinance, in other words, there was a City of Omaha ordinance, and the ordinance said you must have two doors. You must have two exits, two entrances into the house. And the evidence at the motion for summary judgment would have shown that there was a violation. I believe this court's ruling would have been different in Tolbert, and it would have been reversed. Because essentially...
That's a general proposition that violation of a statute is generally some evidence of negligence? Is that a general statement that works?
Yes, and more specifically...
And it might actually be a stronger statement saying you get a dog bite statute.
Yes.
More absolute. Okay.
Yes.
So that would create some kind of strict liability?
That's what a lot of states have actually already done, Justice Hevigan.
Well, did the landlord know of the defect?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes.
Was she requested to fix the defect?
Yes, Justice Wright. In fact, the timeline is in March of 2011.
And did the plaintiff have any other access to the house other than to use those steps?
No.
So it's just a matter of time before she makes a mistake, falls, and injures herself.
Yes.
When I was taking you back to the lease, paragraph 20 of which is entitled Maintenance and Repair, and it's got the lessee will do stuff, and it lists stuff, and then it says major maintenance and repair of the leased premises not due to lessee's misuse, waste, and neglect, or that of his employee, family, agent, or visitor, shall be the responsibility of the lessor. So it's just major maintenance and repair.
I believe.
Okay, so what did the city say? Jack up the foundation?
The city...
Mudjack the foundation.
The city
okay.
said...
Okay, would you expect the tenant to mudjack foundations? Or would you expect that of the landlord?
I would expect that of the landlord.
Would you expect that of the landlord under paragraph 20, major maintenance and repair by the landlord?
Yes.
And what was the allegation in the complaint?
The allegation in the complaint was...
Failed to repair.
Failure to repair.
Okay. So are we under paragraph 20?
We are under paragraph 20 is... I think basically what it boils down to is paragraph 20, the fact that there clearly was a duty.
What about paragraph 9, which says, lessee stipulates that he has examined the demised premises, including the grounds and all buildings and improvements, and that they are, at the time of this lease, in good order, repair, and a safe, clean, and tenable condition.
Well, in addition to public policy going against... If the landlord is able to get out of essentially anything in that way, what incentive do they ever have to comply with the notice of violations and the notices of uninhabitability? In this situation, the city told the landlord 6 months before they ever entered into the lease with Ms. Bernard, no one can live here. It's dangerous, it's unsafe, it's, quote, unfit for human occupancy.
Is there any issue in the record that the repair sought by the city was not done at the time the tenancy commenced?
Yes. In fact, there's an affidavit from Mr. Holmstrom.
There's no dispute.
No
repair was taken prior to tenancy.
I apologize. Yes, I misunderstood. Yes, there's no dispute.
Negative, so I beg your pardon.
There's no dispute. It is correct. There's no dispute that it is clear that there were no repairs made prior to the premise being leased out.
Is there a question that both parties were negligent?
I believe that there is that question, Justice Wright, which is why, in addition, this should go back.
That would be a material issue of fact for the jury.
Exactly. And with that, I'd like to reserve any further time for rebuttal.
Thank you very much. Is it Mr. Waldron? I'm sorry, is it Mr. Waldron?
Walden.
Good morning to you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, here for the defendant. This is really a no-duty determination that the court made. And I'm saying that, using that term, from McReynolds versus Reed-Dorts cited last year, which you noted that there is a revised jurisprudence involving like foreseeability kinds of issues, deciding, you know, when should the jury decide foreseeability versus when should the court, using the restatement third as your guideline.
Is the restatement third, has there been a restatement third issued with respect to this landlord-tenant issue?
Well, what you were going by was Section 7. And that's what McReynolds had to do with. That was not a landlord-tenant case. I think on landlord-tenant issues were really much more what's been stated in Section 8.31 of NJI 2nd. But McReynolds gets at that open and obvious question. It goes off on a exception that the restatement third cites about categorical no-duty determinations. Sure, you're sending off your general kind of foreseeability issues to the jury, but there are certain categories that just don't get to the jury because they're so rooted in public policy.
So your argument is there's no duty between landlord and tenant?
There is, well, to begin with, there is generally not a duty between landlord and tenant for the landlord to fix the things that come up during the tenancy or the things that are obvious to the tenant.
Now, is this something that came up before the tenancy?
It did, and that's what 8.31 gets at. That's an exception. In fact, the comment starts off with that Jameson quote. I mean, the comment to 8.31, it looked like the judge basically went into the database or the comments and got the page. That's
so suppose
exactly
you had
you
a lease agreement and there was a stairway that went upstairs, but it happened to be missing one of the platforms on the stair, and everybody knew that. And are you saying then that in those circumstances, because it's open and obvious, that the plaintiff has no recourse against the landlord for the fact that he or she fell when they were going down the stairs that lacked a platform in one of the steps?
I believe that's what the law is. If it's open and obvious, and not just open and obvious, but actually known by the tenant,
it's also known by the landlord.
Well, that's true, and that's why 8.31 has a set of elements that you go through, and the trial court correctly.
What's the remedy for the tenant not to enter into the lease?
You could not enter into the lease, say fix that before we get going on this thing. Somewhere during the course of it, say, hey, it's your duty to come in here and fix this. She never did any of that. She adapted her way of walking on the step to kind of stepping a little bit sideways, and she heard complaints from her family and friends, people that would visit, kind of stumbled on this. They were telling her about it. Her mother refused to come to the house because, of the condition of the step.
What is the universe of cases to which 8.31 applies?
It's specifically, landlord-tenant.
So it's entitled concealment or concealment of or failure to disclose condition of premise.
That's right, and that's the exception to the general rule of no duty. You have to go through those steps to find a duty.
So your
argument
is this is a case regarding concealment. Yes or no?
Well, yes. And it wasn't concealment. That's what the court
found.
That's
the way you. That's the lens through which you view the case.
Yes, no okay. duty existing between landlord and tenant.
The landlord didn't conceal it. Is that your view? So there's no obligation. Is that your view of it?
That's right. And it's open and obvious, and that's what the Reynolds case
you're
says.
You're saying that the tenant never asked the landlord to fix this?
That's what the record has. She was asked that in depositions. Never asked, no.
I see. So what would be the obligations under paragraph 20 of the lease, and how does that fit with your lens?
I think the tenant asked to fix it, then he's supposed to fix it, but that's as between landlord and tenant under the lease. I don't think that's raising tort duties. If the tenant, you go through a whole different prison when you're looking at the tort duty. And I think you've got to get into things like McReynolds, the open and obvious, the public policy related categories. Public policy is expressed in the general law about.
So your statements with respect to the record are that landlord knows of this gap and tenant knows of this gap.
Yes.
So there hasn't been a concealment. Is that your version of
yes.
how the record is, and no dispute, right? And so therefore, when we turn to the relationship of the parties in paragraph 20 says major maintenance or repair shall be the responsibility of the lessor, that becomes meaningless if the defect is not concealed or obvious.
It's meaningless as a tort matter for personal injury. It has complete meaning as, hey, fix this thing, landlord, and you pay for it, not me. I'll take care of the blinds. If that's not a major repair, you take care of the step, the boiler, whatever.
You're not disputing this would be a major repair when the city says there's a violation and we want you to mud jack the steps. Right.
I think that would be a major repair.
That would fit for a landlord, what landlords do.
Of course, yes.
Okay. So
what impact does the notice from the city have to the landlord?
It gave notice to the landlord.
That unfit for human occupancy.
I don't believe that goes beyond in a tort action like this. The fact that it was a notice to the landlord, and that's one of the elements that the judge found. Yes, there is evidence.
So would that be relevant to the breach of contract, perhaps?
Yes.
But not innocent.
That's right.
It's
more relevant to the city and landlord relationship and the penalties that the city may impose.
Does the landlord have a duty to provide a habitable place?
Of course. And there were repairs that were done, but just not this particular one by the time that he wanted to move in.
So did he get clearance in the city to rent the property?
I'm not familiar with that part of the record, to know if he did or not.
But the violation persisted after her tenancy, according to the record.
In this particular, which is the only particular that is involved in the tort
action. With respect to this.
Step, that's
right. So in the post AW world, with the third restatement, we generally say, as you've indicated, duty is a legal question, right? To do what's reasonable under the circumstances, and then we move on to the elements of negligence, which is brought as a negligence, right?
Would this
be some evidence of, pardon me, move on to the first element being breach. If there were a duty, we'd move on to breach, right? So would this gap that everybody seems to existed prior to the tenancy, would the failure to fix the gap bear on the issue of breach? And would the lease inform our view of breach?
I don't believe the lease really informs us on breach. Like AW was talking about how foreseeability fits into duty versus breach of duty and said, well, it gets over into the breach of duty unless it's one of these categories. Rear-ending somebody is probably another one of those categories. So is there a duty? McReynolds says in an open and obvious case, I mean, he was specifically talking about an open and obvious hazard. there is no duty to warn about what's exactly right there. And you can layer on top of those categories. I mean, that was open and obvious. That was enough for McReynolds. We had, she admittedly knew it. It wasn't just there to see. She's a tenant. That's a public policy related kind of a, you know, how do duties get allocated between tenant and landlord. There's a whole body of law on that. She made no request.
I think maybe you're morphing breach back up to duty, but we'll try to sort it out.
Well, that's what McReynolds said. It's, you don't, on an open and obvious kind of a thing, it is a no-duty determination. It's not a breach of duty that goes on to the jury.
So that would be your view, there was no duty.
That's right.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal? 21 seconds, Mr. Chandler.
Thank you. First, I'd like to clear up that the city did not get permission to lease out the property, and that's clear in the record. It's clear from Inspector Holmstrom stating that actually 2 years after he issued that notice.
So what does that do to this case?
Well, I think it goes back to the open and obvious, and I think the AW case is a good case to reference at this point, because even in the jury instruction 8.31, it states that the issue of open and obvious is to be treated as an issue of comparative negligence. It goes back to foreseeability and breach. And as far as public policy, counsel referenced public policy many times. If we're going to talk public policy, it's clear that allowing landlords to lease out properties that have been deemed uninhabitable for humans would be against public policy. So, thank you.
Thank you very much. The next case of the day.